Our guest today served as the superintendent of the Chicago Police Department for 4 years. He began his career in law enforcement with the New York Police Department 35 years ago. He was raised in the Bronx by his father, a World War II Marine, and his mother, a nurse. And he's so smart that he brought his daughter, Kimberly, with him today. Kimberly, say hi to everybody. Give her a round of applause. Nice city. And even smarter, his wife, who's expecting their first son in 3 weeks, is with him today. Kristen, give her a round of applause. Ladies and gentlemen, Gary McCarthy. Gary?
Kristen's going to kill me for that, just so everybody knows. Well, first of all, thank you, everybody, for standing during my favorite song. I didn't see anybody kneeling. I didn't see anybody with attention-seeking behavior because their NFL career is over. I didn't want to make jokes today because the topic that I'm going to speak about today is so serious. This is about as serious a topic that I have ever discussed publicly. And I've done lectures and I've spoken about emergency response to the World Trade Center, which, as you know, 15 years ago I was there with Rudy Giuliani. And that pales by comparison in my book to what I'm going to talk about today. I've done a lot of speaking, and I generally speak off the cuff. Today, I took the time that I put a lot of effort into this. Actually, for the last 7 weeks, I've been driving my wife crazy because I've been spending so much time at home paying attention to this. And I came up with the title, Legitimizing Noncompliance in America. I want to start by saying that it's my opinion that not one of these young African-American men that we've seen in videos, that we know the stories, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Laquan McDonald, in my opinion, not one of them needed to die. Not one of them. With better training, better tactics, better policies, better supervision, particularly better tactics, each one of those incidents, in my mind, could have been avoided. And we need to do better, and we can do better, through training, supervision, and better policies. But not all of these incidents are criminal. And what has happened? I think the world has been flipped upside down. I think that we're in a culture today that is investigating the police instead of investigating criminals. And I think that there's an action, or there's a reaction for every action. And I think that at the end of the day, officers who behave criminally need to be held accountable. I was a captain in internal affairs in New York City, and some of my proudest moments, believe it or not, was arresting a police officer for robbery first degree. When you put a gun to somebody's head and you say, "Where's the money?" That's a robbery. That's a criminal. That's somebody who I'm proud to put in jail. And I did that. But if appropriate, they should be prosecuted. And if it's against policy, they need to be disciplined. We're paramilitary organizations in the police world, and officers need to be held to those standards. I'm getting that out front, because what I want to talk today about what's happening, not just here in Chicago, but certainly across the country. And what's not being talked about is that almost without exception, and I say almost without exception because I don't know the details of every incident that's happened across the country that we see in the news all the time. Almost without exception, these incidents were precipitated by noncompliance, not just with the law, but also with the police. And one of the things that our friends in CPD will tell you that they heard me say over and over again is confrontation begets confrontation. And that's why training is so important, and that's why professionalism in policing is so important. But through a number of different venues, that noncompliance is becoming legitimized. It's becoming the standard on a daily basis across this country, and it's happening on a whole series of different levels. This is having and will continue to have dire consequences for this city and this country. The problem is being misdiagnosed. You're going to hear me use a lot of medical terms today. No, I'm not a doctor. I don't play one on TV either. I'm a cop. But we think in the same terms as doctors do. And the problem has been misdiagnosed, and instead of correcting a problem, it's my belief that it's being exacerbated. And the thing that jumps to my forefront all the time now is the Hippocratic Oath that doctors have to take. I know we have some doctors here, right? And I know the senior doctors, they don't do it everywhere now, have to take the Hippocratic Oath, which, in essence, one of the quotes from it is, first do no harm. So if you're diagnosing a problem, the first thing that you're expected to do is, A, not make it worse. And that's not what's happening in this country. The solutions that we're using are causing more problems. It's happening across the country. There is a conversation about law enforcement that doesn't include law enforcement. I'm going to say that again. Everybody's talking about the police. The police are not involved in this conversation. I had the opportunity. I was on CNN about 2 months ago, and I was at a town hall with Don Lemon, and there were a number of people there from Black Lives Matter, and I made the offer. I said, if you want to sit down with the leaders of law enforcement in this country, I think I can make it happen. And there was tacit agreement. They all took my business cards. I haven't heard from one since then. I went back to my friends in law enforcement. The next day, I started making phone calls. And in speaking to a number of them, they all said the same thing. They said, you know, we just came from a meeting with the President of the United States, with Black Lives Matter. And the President made that offer, and it was refused. So the question is, where are we going? And I don't know the answer. But I could tell you where we're going is based on where we're coming from, and it's definitely in the wrong direction. Simply stated, the police are not the problem in this country. The criminals are. And I don't think anybody has the audacity to say that today, because politically speaking, you're either on the bus or under it. No. No, that is not a backhanded reference to anything that may or may not have happened to me. So where were we? Right? Where were we here in the city of Chicago? And my comments really reflect a national picture, but I'm going to talk a lot about Chicago, obviously. Where were we? So in 4.5 years that I was the police superintendent, the men and women of the department achieved a 38% overall reduction in crime. We had back-to-back record-setting years, 2013 and 2014, of the lowest murder rate in this city since 1965. We did that by making about 20,000 less arrests during 2013 and 2014. And if you know about it, I apologize, but many people don't realize the issues with mass incarceration and the structure of our narcotics laws in this country, the war on narcotics that started way back in the Reagan years, and its effect on the African-American community. So by making less arrests, we got better results. And even by making less arrests, we got a 23% increase in gun arrests, right? Probably the most important thing we do, because illegal possession of a loaded firearm is the gateway crime to committing a murder. We had back-to-back years, 2013 and 2014, of 50% reductions in complaints by civilians against our officers. I'm going to say that again. Back-to-back years, 50% reductions. And the last thing that you do not hear is during the 4.5 years that I was police superintendent, there was a 68% reduction in police-related shootings. We shot 68% less people than when I got here in 2011. And how did we do that? We did that through policy, supervision, and training. As a matter of fact, because we achieved those things, we were involved, I don't know if you know this, but a couple of years ago, the president put together something called the President's 21st Century Task Force on Policing. And they put together a really serious group of intelligent and diverse individuals from different backgrounds who went around the country looking for best practices in policing. They compiled it all into a report, and they put the report out nationwide to policing. Well, we participated in it, and I was proud to participate in it. And when we received the report, I was astonished to see that 92% of their recommendations were already implemented in the Chicago Police Department. 92%. The other 8% we couldn't do because of contractual obligation or Illinois state law. How about that? So the best practices in the country, 92%. We were able to achieve. Now, all of those things we did happened against the backdrop of history. And what hasn't changed is the lack of sufficient gun laws in the state of Illinois. I've spoken about it and spoken about it and spoken about it. So for purposes of this discussion, I'm going to put it aside. But those gun laws have not changed, and they do need to change. What I am going to talk about is history. I'm a big history buff. I study it. And it's really critical to policing, especially in this day and age. We have a well-deserved bad reputation in the African-American community in policing. I said it, well-deserved. And one of the things that I've done from the time I got here is acknowledge the history, right? Because recognition is the first step towards redemption. You have to first acknowledge how we got here. And I want you to think about this because most people don't. The fact is, from slavery to black codes to Jim Crow to segregation was legal in my lifetime. Legal segregation. Those racist laws, not policies, those were laws in the United States, were enforced by who? The white police officer. So at the end of the day, when people talk about reestablishing trust, I kind of chuckle. Because that narrative of distrust goes back 300 plus years. And if we're going to change that narrative, we have to first recognize it. It's not going to happen because of body cameras, guys. It's not going to happen. It's going to happen through different means. It's going to be a process. And we make it worse, right? You take that backdrop. It dawned on me years ago. Jay said my dad was a World War II Marine. He was not fond of the Japanese for obvious reasons, because he got shot 3 times. All his friends got killed in places like Guadalcanal and Iwo Jima. And when he passed away, he still had that thing about the Japanese. And it dawned on me that war ended in 1945, yet segregation was legal in my lifetime, in the early 60s. When it was legally abolished, right? That narrative is going to continue for generations. And it deserves to be, and it needs to be recognized. But for some reason, everybody's afraid to talk about race, and I don't understand it. Then what happens, we make it worse with high-profile incidents where we screw up. We make mistakes. The police make mistakes all the time. We see them. We see them frequently. The one that really stands out in my mind was the one in North Charleston, South Carolina, where after a car stop, a black man got out of a car and started running, and the officer just shot him in the back. I can't for the life of me imagine what was going through that officer's mind. But just like any other officer who uses deadly physical force, that individual has to account for it, and he needs to be held accountable. So you take all these bad incidents, you take this history of racism in the country, and you ball it all together, and I'm going to bring something back up that I've talked about before. Hey, look at that. It actually works. The concept of legal cynicism. Legal cynicism is a cultural orientation in which the law and its agents of enforcement are viewed as illegitimate, unresponsive, and ill-equipped to ensure public safety. All right? Everybody chew on that for a second. But I want you to focus on the last part, which is ill-equipped to ensure public safety. This is from research, right? And this goes to the entire criminal justice system. It's not just the police. It goes to prosecutors. It goes to judges. It goes to corrections authorities and sheriffs. It goes to parole and probation. The system's not working. People see the same people getting arrested all the time, and they come right back to the places where they came from, and nothing changes. And what I am going to propose to you all is that a lot of the anger and frustration in the disenfranchised communities, which is overrun by rampant narcotics and crime, the breakup of the family unit, poor health care, particularly including poor mental health care, right? Lead in the water, joblessness, hopelessness, lack of education and opportunity, is viewed as a result of a government system that has failed that community. Does that make sense? The government is not providing people the very basic needs that you have in a free society. And who is it that is the most forward and visible component of that failed government system? It's the police. Who goes into the homes? Who comes when you call 911 besides EMS and first responders like firemen? It's us. And what do? We break up families. We lock up parents in front of their children. This narrative becomes the prism by which everything that we do is viewed. So what I'm suggesting is this. What's happening in this country, the anger towards police, the frustration in the disenfranchised community, has a lot less to do with the police than it does a failed social and economic system that causes the anger and frustration to build up. That is generational. This is nothing new. This didn't just start happening in Chicago or Detroit or the Bronx. This has been going on for 300 plus years. The greatest danger to what's happening in this country today is the fact that we've misdiagnosed this issue. The medicines that we are applying are literally killing people through hamstrung policing and empowered criminals. And the legitimizing of that is about the fact that what's happening in this country is less about what the police aren't doing and more about what the criminals are doing. Nobody's willing to say that. The narratives just don't match. The greatest danger in my mind to American society today is the legitimizing of the noncompliance with the law. Compliance is a bedrock principle of the United States Constitution based in the social contract. This goes back to John Locke and Rousseau. Sister Mary Joseph would be proud. I was listening, right, in civic class, right? The Constitution itself becomes invalid without compliance to the law. The social contract has it, just to remind you all of what Sister Mary Joseph told me, is that you give up certain freedoms to live in a civilized society. And I'm boiling it down to very small words. But you can't pick up a gun and walk down the street and shoot people. And when the Constitution, when the law is not being complied with, what happens is it's going to erode, leading to the lawlessness that we're seeing. We're reaching a state of lawlessness, not just in Chicago. Look at what happened in Dallas. Look at what's happening in New York and New Jersey right now. Look at what happened in Baton Rouge. We're reaching a state of lawlessness in this country. And there's a lot of reasons and plenty of responsibility to go around. And when I first wrote this, I used the word blame. But I changed it to responsibility. To go around and what's forcing this changing dynamic. And I've already acknowledged that we need to do better as the police. Fact. Giving it to you. Period. No disputing it. But I'm going to go further. Community leaders here in Chicago encouraging young people to not cooperate with the police. Going into the convention in Cleveland, I saw a man on TV, an alleged community leader, who was encouraging people to not be compliant with the police in Cleveland during the convention. And he also said that he was told and he was going to bring a gun. That's great leadership from community leaders. Look at what happened on Michigan Avenue. Peaceful protests? No way, folks. We have pictures and video of police officers being assaulted at protests all the time, and we can't get them prosecuted because of the politics of what's happening here. Punching officers in the face and being able to walk. That's empowering criminals. Elected officials. Elected officials are now establishing policy in police agencies across the country. Body cameras is a great example. I like body cameras, don't get me wrong. But body cameras are not going to be the panacea. People say, well, isn't it going to build trust? I don't think so. Releasing videos, making policies to release videos when there's a criminal or a civil action pending. I want you all to think about this for a second. If I was asked, and I was not, I would have recommended not releasing the Laquan McDonald video. For no other reason than we don't release evidence in a criminal investigation. Have you ever seen it? We don't say this is what we've got when the case is still pending. We don't do that. And there's not an attorney that I've spoken to who probably wouldn't say this publicly, right? Because you're either on the bus or under it. There's not an attorney that I've spoken to who likes the idea of having evidence in a case that's being prosecuted or pending being released to the public right now. We're legislating good policing. Here in Illinois, we had the Community Relations Improvement Act, which came out of Springfield 123. We've been fighting for gun laws for years. God forbid we stop people from dying. Let's focus on the less than half of 1% of the shootings in Chicago, which, by the way, do you know that? Police-related shootings in the city of Chicago are less than one-half of 1% of the shootings in Chicago. And this year, we've already got more than 3,000 people shot. Let's focus on that. Let's legislate a two-page contact card. Now, contact cards. We're going to go into that in a moment. But contact cards. We can legislate two pages. So now when an officer stops somebody on the street, it's akin to doing a robbery investigation. Instead of just finding out who they are, whether or not they're wanted, and cutting them loose, whether or not they have or are about to commit a crime. We have elected officials campaigning on police violence. I actually heard a quote-unquote presidential candidate, whose name I'm not even going to mention to give her that opportunity, campaigning on police violence. This is empowering criminals. All of this, by the way, is being done in the name of what the community wants, quote unquote, right? Well, in the Laquan McDonald case, I could tell you, if you listen to what you hear across the country, communities want civilian oversight of police departments. Well, here in Chicago, we have that. It's called the police board. I was not the final determiner of discipline in the Chicago Police Department, even though I was accountable for everybody's behavior. Communities around this country want outside investigations into police uses of force. Well, here in Chicago, we have it. We had IPRA. Apparently, now we have a new group. I haven't really read up on that. I'm actually trying to go cold turkey on this whole cop thing. It's not working. Communities across this country want federal investigations into police uses of force, which, in the Laquan McDonald case, we have. IPRA went right to the FBI. The FBI went to the U.S. attorney, who impaneled the grand jury, God knows how long ago, but it still hasn't come out with its findings. Anybody recognize or notice that or forget about it? So that's what the community wants, and what were the results? Not what everybody wanted to see, was it? Certainly not what I wanted to see. So just because people want it doesn't mean it's a good idea. Releasing videos is not going to build trust. And by the way, if the video comes out today or if the video comes out 2 years from now and the case is over, does it make much of a difference? But if you're compromising a criminal investigation, I think it makes a really, really, really big difference. This is empowering criminals. My friends from the media, not going to let you all off the hook. I'm sure everybody in this room heard yesterday that there's a, I believe it's a Gallup poll, that just said that trust in the media is at an all-time low, 32%. 32%. But the media is talking about trust in the police. Get that one. I think that that's a result of an obsession for creating the news rather than reporting the news. And it's natural that it happens because they're competing for ratings. These are businesses who have to make money. But I'm sorry, it's not TMZ. You could still do journalism at the same time. And I actually watched one of the national networks yesterday, and they had four talking heads on, all defending their positions about why they do what they do. Kind of sounds familiar. But, you know, 2 weeks ago, there was an officer killed in New Mexico. And the tagline, the banner across the bottom of the TV, because I get up every morning and turn on the news, said that there was a police officer killed in New Mexico in a shootout with a suspect, but it's unclear who fired first. Did you hear that? It's unclear who fired first, as if the officer might have tried to murder this individual and to defend himself, he killed the officer. That's the way that was reported. It's the most disgusting thing that I've seen on TV in a long time. And how many times have you heard another police shooting caught on video? All these shootings are not bad. You know, when I hear this, I naturally have to watch it. And the most recent example was the video of the guy shooting out of the car at the police officers here with the bullets ricocheting off the windshield. And guess what? The Chicago PD did not kill that man. But that video you don't see played over and over and over again, do you? This empowers criminals, ladies and gentlemen. The last category that I want to kind of put on blast, and I didn't know how to wrap this up, is the government. And this is a big one to me. And I'm going to talk about the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice now wants us to construct our crime strategies based upon population demographics. They want us to make our stop data. By the way, I know what you're thinking. Good idea, Gary. Go after the Department of Justice, right? Well, what are they going to do, get me for having top secret information on my server? I had to. But the Department of Justice now wants us to construct our crime strategies based upon population demographics. And what am I talking about? They've now opened 22 investigations, and they will tell you they're very proud to open those investigations in the last 8 years into civil rights violations by police departments across this country. Now, I don't mean to sound critical of that, but what I am going to question is whether every one of them is an investigation into a civil rights pattern, or is it an investigation into something else? And my biggest issue is what are the standards that they're using to investigate these police departments. And I'm going to talk about something called Terry stops, which most of you may be not familiar with, but it's the quote-unquote, and I hate these words, stop and frisk issue. Now, a couple of years ago, when this issue exploded in New York and I was police superintendent here, my press guy actually came to me and he said, "You realize, of course, this is going to come back to you." And I said, "Of course, everything's my fault." And this was 2 years ago. He says, "Well, what are we going to do?" I said, "We're going to tell the truth." He says, "What are you talking about?" I said, "We don't stop people based on population demographics." Terry versus Ohio in 1968, the Supreme Court of the United States said that the police can stop people based upon articulable, reasonable suspicion. Now, what creates articulable, reasonable suspicion? It's going to be training, experience, observation, and call me crazy, but I say crime data. Where is crime happening? Who's committing it? And when are they committing those crimes? You know, the city of Chicago Police Department seizes more guns than any city in the country every year. 3-1 in comparison to Los Angeles, 7-1 in comparison to New York. Those people don't come up to the police and say, I have a gun, please arrest me. As a matter of fact, one thing that I found, because I was out there with the troops, one of my favorite things to do in life, was the fact, and I was struck, it was odd to me, that when you encounter somebody with a gun in New York and New Jersey, where I worked, they drop the gun and run. But what I realized here is that they keep the gun. In one case, last year, two officers on-viewed a man shooting at somebody on the street. They got into a foot pursuit. They got into a vehicle pursuit with this guy. He ran on foot, hopped into a car. They got into a second foot pursuit. And they caught this guy literally hiding in one of those big trash bins. And you know where the gun was after that length of time? It was in his waistband. And I realized that the reason why they don't drop the gun is because the sanction from the gang is greater than the sanction from the criminal justice system here in Chicago. And the question becomes, why wouldn't you carry a gun? Well, folks, that's why we take more guns off the street than any place else in the country. But here's what I want to get to, and this is important. Articulable, reasonable suspicion. When we took a look, and we did this right away, we did a 2-year analysis of crime here in Chicago. Now I'm going to need my glasses for this part. So forgive me. But if you take a look, now this isn't going to work. So at this bottom chart, this is all districts. This is a 2-year comparison or analysis of crime. And what we found is right here, if you take a look, race, right, African American, Latino, other, white, district demographics. So this is the entirety of the city. 32% of the city is African American, 29% Latino, 32% white, right? Contacts. We're stopping, 71% of our stops were African American. Well, that sounds like a problem, doesn't it? Because only 32% of the population is African American. But when we looked at crime data, you get robbed right now outside Maggiano's. You call the police and you say, I just got robbed. What do we say? Who robbed you? Crime reports from civilian victims of crime said that, where are we? Suspect. 72%, 73% of our crime offenders in the city of Chicago reported by crime victims were African American. And that's why we're stopping 71% African Americans. Not because the population demographic is 32%, but because the crime demographic says otherwise. Now, take this and look at it in different places across the city. This is one that I really enjoy. 19th District, Lincoln Park, Halsted Avenue corridor, good neighborhood, right? Wrigley. The demographic of African Americans is only 7%. Yet, we're stopping 48% African Americans. What does the crime data say? It says 53% of the crime committed there is committed by African Americans. I want you to picture being an officer working in the 7th District. 7th District is Englewood. It's the most violent district in the city. It is 97% African American. According to the Department of Justice, in the 7th District, we're supposed to be stopping 31% white folks. That one guy is going to get stopped a lot. So that's who we're stopping. Now the question becomes, where are we stopping? This is just a chart that reflects that same data. This is the citywide numbers. Okay, not so interesting. I already gave you the punchline here. But this is the where we're stopping them. Okay? So here's the deal. If you look, this is public violence, this chart right here. District by district in the city. The 20th District, the 1st District, the 16th District are the lowest. On this side, the highest are the 6th, the 11th, and the 7th district. This is a two-year analysis, 2013-2014. Okay? These are our stops, right? 20th district, the fewest stops in the city, pretty close, right? With the 11th district, the 7th district, looks like a pretty good graph to me. And when you put them together, looks like we're doing the stops in the right places. Next chart. When are we stopping people? So the blue line are contact cards. This is our stops. And the red line is public violence. Matches up pretty well, if you ask me. Crime reduction is about who you stop, where you stop, and when you stop. And the fact is, I always thought that Department of Justice enforced the law, and the Supreme Court interpreted and made the law. If we got sued and went to court and said that we were stopping people based upon population demographics, I believe that the Supreme Court would say it's unconstitutional. But that's the standard that's being used across the country right now. Very confusing for the police. Very difficult to get your job done. In my book, this is empowering criminals. Last thing is the Inspector General recently came out with a report regarding the Laquan McDonald case where a number of officers allegedly may have made false statements. I already talked about the fact that you don't proceed with an administrative hearing when there's a criminal case pending. The 10 individuals who the Inspector General just found or determined through their investigation that they had not told the truth are 10 witnesses to first-degree murder charge against a police officer. And they've now been impeached and cannot testify if they were going to tell the truth or were going to lie. This is compromising the possibility of getting a conviction. And then what's going to happen? There's going to be a lot of anger. Long-standing policies are out the window, and mixed messages are being sent. Why would you stop anyone if you were a police officer today in Chicago? Why would you stop anyone when the Department of Justice is here investigating the patterns and practices of what we do and looking for civil rights violations? Why would you stop anyone when very confusing data, very confusing policies are being pushed? Supreme Court says this, DOJ says that. What do I do? What do I do? All of this together is empowering criminals. All of this together is creating an ineffective police and a more emboldened criminal. Criminals are being given free rein, and we investigate the police, not criminals. I want to reference a recent case in Chicago where I changed the policy about shooting into vehicles a couple of years ago. I said that you cannot shoot into a vehicle unless deadly physical force other than the vehicle is being used against you. Kind of makes sense to me. Because if you actually hit and kill the person who's driving that car, now you've got a 2,000-pound bullet going down the street, don't you? So it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me. We changed that policy. That's one of the reasons why there's such a substantial drop in police-related shootings in Chicago. My information came from the media. I have no inside information regarding this case. But watching the video, it looks to me like the officers fired outside of policy. It looks to me like they shouldn't have fired into the car based on policy. It's probably a legal shooting based upon life extenuating circumstances, but it's against policy. That's all you've heard about this. You know what I'm waiting for? I'm waiting for somebody to say, I've got an idea. Don't steal a car. Don't take the police on a high-speed chase. And definitely don't crash your vehicle into a police car 50 miles an hour, causing a violent confrontation, and then be upset about the results. It doesn't mean it's okay, and it's not okay. But the fact is, that conversation needs to be had, because this is empowering criminals. This is reaching a state of lawlessness in this country. Where are we now? In the city of Chicago, Every crime category that we track is up, and I believe it's about 20%. Murders are up about 50%. If we reach the number, and some people are saying that they think we're going to reach 700 murders in this city, I want to put this in context for you. The worst year that New York ever had was 1990. There were 2,245 people murdered in 1990 at the height of the crack epidemic in New York City. Chicago is about one-third the size of New York. So if we reach 700 murders in this city, it puts us in the ballpark for the worst year that New York ever had 26 years ago. Talk about unacceptable. Shootings are up about 50%, and stops by the police are down 95%. Do you think any of this is by accident? We're creating a culture here that, like I said, is legitimizing noncompliance in America. Well, what did we think was going to happen with all these things that I kind of pointed out that are going on? Every action has a reaction, and our actions are backfiring. You can't legislate good policing or community relations. There are no political solutions for practical problems. And if you misdiagnose the issue, we're addressing a smaller symptom of a much larger problem and not even acknowledging that larger problem. People are literally dying while we continue an ongoing commitment to a failed endeavor. Remember legal cynicism? Remember what I said? Ill-equipped to ensure public safety. So all these steps that we're taking in policing across this country and here in Chicago, is that ensuring the public safety or am I missing something? Has it been this bad in Chicago since the 90s? I don't think so. So not only are we not equipped to ensure the public safety, but our policies are actually promoting violence and crime. We're taking the wrong medicine for what ails us. We're treating a small symptom of a big problem. If we continue down this path, we're going to have this conversation in 5 years, and we're going to wonder why it hasn't changed. Crime reduction and cultural change are processes that don't happen overnight. They're processes. But after all, this is Chicago, where we don't want nobody sent. Well, if you think what we're doing is working, then by all means, continue, folks.
Pastor Harris, are you here? Come on up. Come on up. Well, while he's coming up, I have one question. You alluded to it. Gary, what was it like standing next to New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani when the first plane hit?
Well, actually, I was standing next to him when the second plane hit. I missed the first one. There was shock. Shock is probably the best thing. But one of the things that we knew that was happening, you know, when I talk about crisis management, you have to have a plan. You have to train the plan to your individuals, and you have to practice that plan. And even though we had no communication, when the North Tower came down, we lost our communications. Even though there was mayhem, one of the things that was really satisfying was I actually took my Nextel, which I had never used at that point, and went out to the scene and was reporting back to police headquarters what was going on. And everywhere I went, there were mobilization points, and officers were coming in from all over the city, being put on rosters so we knew who was there, given assignments, and going out and doing those things. We had trained our plan, and we knew that we were giving it the best response that we possibly could. It was crazy, certainly crazy. And quite frankly, the worst part of 9/11 was not what happened that day. It was the aftermath. Recovering bodies, finding out who died, going to funerals, dealing with families. I thought you left, Pastor.
No, I didn't. You didn't scare me away. Can you clap your hands for Gary McCarthy one more time, everybody? So I didn't volunteer, but when you're voluntold to do something, I assume this is supposed to be proof that community police relations is getting better. So let me just start off, since they asked me to do this. Let me say thank you for your courage to address the horrific history of African Americans in America. And also thanks for acknowledging that a lack of investment in urban communities play a major role in this problem. You said the police are not the problem, criminals are. I submit crooked and racist cops are certainly part of the problem, just like criminals in urban communities are. I'd love to poke some holes in that data that you presented. We can have some fun with that over coffee. It should also be...
It's time to go.
I know, right? See? See, it should be noted that no organization represents the entire black community, and more than 80% of the protesters were actually peaceful because I was out there. But here's my question. Based on data, when whites are noncompliant, do they die or are treated the same way as blacks and Latinos?
Well, actually, it's a great question, and I know it's true because I saw it on CNN. More white individuals are shot and killed by police nationally than blacks. So that's the only data that I have on that topic. So I would say that it's the same issue. Confrontation begets confrontation.
From Ms. George Johnson, who is a member, culture is evaporating in a negative manner rapidly because parents in certain areas express a profound need for a leader who looks like them. Do you feel, as the former unfairly ousted chief, this does not benefit them or any parent in a culture of gun violence?
So I actually do have some very strong opinions about this. In New York City, when we had the Abner Louima scandal, anybody here remember that? That's when some officers assaulted a Haitian immigrant in the 70th precinct in Flatbush, Brooklyn. Howard Safer was the police commissioner at the time, and he didn't send an African-American to that precinct to try and heal the wounds. He sent me. And, you know, I'm not accustomed. I got to tell you something. Growing up in a pretty multicultural environment in the Bronx, I used to speak Spanish fluently. I didn't experience how bad racism could be until I actually went to Newark. And then when I got here and I looked at the history of Chicago, how it was built this way on purpose, and all of these things that have happened, that's when it really came clear to me. But again, recognizing where we came from, to me, that's the first solution. And nobody's talking about that. And what is it that we could do to build a plan to grow out of it? I don't think that I have to look like you, Pastor, to police in your community. My wife will tell you I'm probably too sensitive, right? But I'm sensitive to what goes on, and different cultures have different hurdles that they've overcome, too. Even the Irish.
Susan McKenna asks, how do you build morale of officers when they are reasonably more fearful for their lives?
Well, in my case, I would say personal leadership. Some of the best conversations that I had with police officers during my tenure here in Chicago would happen at 1 o'clock in the morning on street corners in places like Englewood or West Garfield Park. Being out with them, doing the things that they do, and leading them and showing them how to do it is one of the greatest satisfying experiences that I've ever had in my life. And now more than ever, we need that. But, you know, there's an understandable fear that these officers have, not just for their lives, because, you know, if you – a more ineffective policing agency becomes more dangerous for everybody, not just for the civilians. You know, the police have the obligation to go out and do it, and sometimes it's difficult, but I fall back on personal leadership.
Stephen Shucker asked, if you could spend one full calendar year in Rahm Emanuel's shoes as mayor of Chicago, what would be your largest singular focus?
I don't know if I even want to answer that question. I am not an elected official. I'm not a politician. I have no desire to do that. You look at the fiscal crisis that the city has, the pension issue, the teachers, the schools, the crime. You know, it's a handful. He's got a very, very, very difficult job. Eddie Johnson has the second most difficult job in this country, in my book. But, you know, when you're faced with so many challenges at once, and I've been in these situations before, you got to sit down, you got to construct a plan, and there's no quick fixes for these things. It's not about, there's no fairy dust out there. And again, we're looking for a panacea right now to fix police-community relations. You can't fix something that hasn't existed before, and there's no quick fix for it. So what I would do is peel back the onion and bite off chunks, step at a time.
Unless we have other questions, this is the last one. We have more coming? Okay. The last question. Ruby S., who is a member, can you speak to how much Rahm Emanuel knew about the Laquan McDonald situation when it disappeared? Was there a cover-up?
No, I can't talk. Look, I've said this publicly a number of times. The mayor was not in control of what was happening with that video. The Corporation Council was defending the policies at the time. Like I said earlier, if I was asked, I would have recommended not releasing that video. If I was asked. Now, the Corporation Council was fighting the lawsuit to release it. And that is the policy that was in place at the time. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. The mayor was not in charge of the Cook County State's Attorney's Office to determine when or if the officer was going to be charged. So, you know, conspiracy theories can be fun, right? JFK, Lincoln, Warren Commission, you name it. But that's simply not the case here. The mayor did not have the capacity to prevent that video from going out.
Thank you, Pastor Harris. Thank you very much.